Today's talk will be on case 49 in the Hikikanroku in the Blue Rock Collection. Case 49 is entitled Sancho's the Golden Carp Out of the Net. Mango's introduction. Seven piercing and eight breaking through, seizing the drums and capturing the banners. 100 barriers and 1,000 checkpoints, watching the front and guarding the rear, holding the tiger's head and securing its tail. Even all these are not comparable to the veteran master's ability. The ox head disappearing, the horse head appears. That also is not a great wonder. Tell me, what do you do when a man of transcendent experience comes? See the following. Main subject. Sancho said to Seppo, "The golden carp is out of the net. Tell me, what will it feed on?" Seppo said, "When you have got out of the net, I will tell you." Sancho said, "The renowned teacher of 1,500 monks cannot find even one word to say about this topic." Seppo said, "I am the chief abbot and have much to attend to." Secho's verse. The golden carp comes out of the net. Don't say it remains in the water still. It shakes the heavens and moves the earth, swinging its fins, lashing its tail. It blows like a whale, raising great waves. Then the thunder sounds and a cool breeze comes. A cool breeze, yes, a cool breeze comes. Who in the whole universe knows this? So, Kurt is not here today, but he's away this weekend, but he'll be back on Monday. Really kind of lucked out with the weather, I think. It was kind of in the background all week what was going to happen. And I'm really glad it worked out the way it did. Actually, the way the weather worked out is pretty good. Keith was saying to me this morning how much he loves this kind of weather. Just kind of the blusteriness of it kind of fills you up and makes you feel really alive and like very energetic. And maybe part of that is just the heat of the summer and the change from that. But I know I've had the same experience. I really feel fall is my favorite season. And that's the reason why. I just really feel very energized, and the colors of the leaves and when they turn and everything that changes is really nice for me. I like it a lot. So we all came here this morning, and we're all sat for at least two periods, and some of us more. And so that can be very energizing too. That can really give a person, set you up for the rest of the day. It can keep going. After you leave here, it can keep going. Hopefully it will do that. So this is one of my favorite cones, and I don't pretend to know everything about cones, but I do like this one very much, and part of that is, well, there may be just one or two people in the group who have not really learned a lot about cones. Most of us know a bit, but for anyone who they're still very puzzled by them. That's a good thing. That's what you're supposed to be. They are really, on the surface of them, just little stories. They usually involve two people, either a teacher and a student, or two Zen masters, two Dharma brothers who are awake and testing each other. And in this case, I think that's what the situation is. I think these two people in this koan are pretty deeply awake. And so the idea of koans, as I understand it, is that you can look at any of them almost on two levels. Now today we're talking about it. I'm talking about one. We're talking about the details. We're thinking about the details of it, what it could possibly mean. That is one level you can look at a koan from. It's not the most important part of a koan, though. Koans are meant to resonate on a much deeper level with us. And usually we don't realize that's happening. We're focused on the images that they give us. But they do, there's something in there that was designed by the author of the koan to reach a place that you couldn't really reach just by thinking. So, I do like this koan. I like to think about it. I like to think about the image of the fish. I think about that. The fish is really kind of constrained. And that's the thing about koans, is that they're all different aspects. You know, every time I read one, I see another part of it that, for that particular time, means more than the rest. So today it was the fish, and it was the idea of his struggle. And what occurred to me with that is that any fish caught in a net is not going to realize what's happening. It's not going to understand, oh, look, I'm in a net, I have to get out of here. That's not what happens. All they are is swimming through the water, totally free, and all of a sudden they can't. All of a sudden they're restricted. They're held by something they don't realize is holding them. And they are instantly in a panic, because that's how they breathe. Most of them, when they're swimming, they're actually oxygenating themselves. So it would be like if you were to all of a sudden not be able to breathe. It's like panic time. And that's what a fish caught in a net is feeling. So it is with us too. We are often struggling. That's the best word I can think of for it. We often find ourselves struggling in situations with things that we don't understand. We don't really comprehend why or how this came about, but there we are, and this struggling seems like a really bad thing. In Zen practice, Well, we sit on a cushion. We come and we sit on a cushion, and especially in the beginning, the beginning years of our practice, or the beginning time, that's different for everyone. We might feel like this practice is really, it's really just struggling, you know, from one sit to the next, because our legs hurt, because we have to get the posture right, because learning to breathe this way is a skill, and we develop it over time, and it does get better and better, but we may look at this part of it as something that's holding us back, something that is keeping us from progressing, when in fact I believe that very often the struggling part of it is a sign of progress. In a strange way, if there was no such thing as being free, as being liberated, there wouldn't be any reason to struggle. The fact that we have to do the work of this, the Zen work of this, is a very positive thing. I call it Zen effort. It's a good effort. It's actually one of the eight basic eightfold path. It's an important one. And if we learn about this more, we learn that every time you really practice one part of the eightfold path, you're really practicing the whole path. The other seven, whichever one you choose, the other seven go right along with it, and they all work together. And the effort of Zen, of working on the cushion, is a very, very positive part of this practice. And it does go on. It changes. It doesn't stay the same as it was at the beginning, but it's always there. We always have to make a good effort. So the struggling part is a little bit different from, as I see it, from what we see with with the image of a fish in extremis, in panic, fighting for its life. Well, in a way, maybe we are too. Maybe there's something there that we know on some level is there that we're trying to reach. And every time we go to sit down on a cushion, we may feel, it may not feel like a struggle. It may feel like a resistance. That can happen too. And that was, honestly, that was my biggest challenge with this over the beginning years, and still at times is. I want to do it so much, and yet something gets in front of me, something holds me, something grips me, and sometimes I have to really almost force myself. But once I begin, it's great. It's much different from the beginning. We're not the only ones. Actually, you can look at the Buddha, at the way his life progressed, and that would show you how positive this is. Because I've actually read various interpretations of that final night, that night when he sat under the Bodhi tree, and in the morning, and he vowed he would not move until he really understood, and then in the morning, he saw the morning star, and he was enlightened. But there was a lot that went on in between those two moments, and there's various stories. Various people have written some very dramatic stories of that night. There's a wonderful, I think, wonderful little movie. It's not so little, it's probably a couple of hours long, but I was able to get it through PBS, and it's entitled The Buddha. And it's his whole life done really well. It's a mixture of animation and people who are known within the Buddhist community talking about, you know, different aspects of different times in his life and how they relate to Buddhist practice. And it's just done really well. But two of the things I remember from that was when he was a child, he had an experience that he didn't understand. And he was sitting out under a tree. His father, the people, they were plowing the field, actually. They were plowing fields to plant. And he was sitting there, and he apparently had sat there for a while. And he noticed these little insects that were on the ground, and it opened his heart in a special way. He didn't just notice them. He realized that the plows were killing them, and he realized that these plows going through the fields were destroying certain life forms. And even as a child, that moved him deeply. But it passed. The night he sat under the Bodhi tree, as the story goes, he was attacked by Mara. Mara, who is not like the Christian demons that we hear about, but still in all, Mara actually represents his shadow side, the Buddha's shadow side, in some interpretations of the story. And that makes sense to me. I mean, these stories that go back 2,000 years, 2,500 years, a lot of it, we have to remember, is legend mixed in with fact. And so Mara attacks him with his army of demons. And I think in one story, it even says an elephant that's supposed to frighten the Buddha and make him give up what he is about to accomplish and make Mara the one who is at the center of everything. So it doesn't work, because the Buddha is, well, he's alone. He realizes he's alone. And he touches the earth. And in one dramatic story, the earth roars and scares. The elephant kneels down, and the earth roars and scares all the demons away. Well, actually, if you really look at that image, it's what seems to me to be the result of all those 7 or 8 years of intense practice, of self-denial, of learning from other teachers. All of this, it didn't feel as he was moving through it as though anything was happening, but all of a sudden, all of those shadows, all of those obstacles, all of those aspects of his personality that had held him back disappeared. They left. And that was when he opened up to the world in that very special way, and he woke up. So that's, you know, he's a good example of struggle and positive outcome that can come from it. There's more to this practice, though. There's more to coming to this practice than that. There's something also called cooperating causes. Now, in the year of, it was around February in the year 2002, I think. That was my first sit ever. I had never been in a Zen group. I was determined to learn how to meditate well, but I had not yet found the home that I needed to be, where I needed to be. And so that was my first sit. I didn't know even after that first sit that I was home, but within a couple of years I did. Before that, a lot happened. I mean, a lot, as I think back over my lifetime, a lot happened to bring me there. I was for 50-something years, in my late 50s, so for all those years I was very active in a Catholic parish. I had my ups and downs about certain things, but, and there was something inside me that was, that knew that there was more, but I didn't, you know, question too much, and I kept, as time passed, though, I became more drawn towards the contemplative side of my religion than the ritual side. So that was one thing that happened. I started to really want to be silent. Nothing more than that. I just wanted to find a place where I could go and just be totally silent. Very hard to do in this world, in this culture, and with a family. So I found a silent retreat in a Benedictine monastery, and I went there, and I can still remember the feeling of closing that door behind me and that silence coming down around me. And it was wonderful. It was, I knew I was heading in the right direction. But there were other things too, because I also began to realize that I didn't want to do this by myself, that I wanted to learn to be with other people. So I did things like, I went to a chapel and I sat there with one other person in silence, and there was a little group that formed where I worked. I worked in hospice. And I did that, and little by little, I mean, it went from wanting just to be silent to wanting to be silent with others. And by that time, I was really starting to learn a little bit about a certain kind of meditation. So finally, I joined a centering prayer group, and that was like as far as I went before coming to Zen. But even before that, there were things, you know, as I look back over my whole life, there were things that pointed me without me realizing it. There was this dumb game. You're going to think this is silly, but I mean, this was years and years before. Kurt said this was, actually he said this was disgusting. That's what he said. But it was years and years before I knew about meditation or anything like that. And somebody taught me to play this game called Osho Zen Tarot. And I mean, the game was nothing. It was like, but there was like these little meditations that were written by somebody who was involved with in a Zen way, or in a, you know, that kind of thinking. And I had never read anything like that. And it turned me inward. in a certain way that was the start of something. You know, I had never before thought about any of that. And even before that, like natural childbirth, that now we're going back to 1971, and that was really just getting started. But they taught you to breathe, they taught you to focus, they taught you to watch your breath and to focus. Again, I was somebody who had never really turned in that way. And all of these things, I mean, they're very unlikely. You wouldn't think of them as being anything that would be send you towards Zen. And yet, you can be pointed from all kinds of directions. You know, it's like there's so many situations that come up that there's something in them that will turn you a certain way. And I've always kind of felt that I've never been off the path. That's been my feeling. I mean, I spent my whole life on a path. Even as a kid, even as a really small child, I can remember clearly sitting in a car, looking out the window, trying to stay in the moment. There was something about making my mind stay still, even for a few seconds, that was attractive to me, that made me think to do that. So, all of this to me is just shows how things that happen can come together from the most unlikely places. Things can be happening in your life that you would never in a million years associate with anything spiritual or you know, Zen-like. And somehow, some little part of what that experience is forming you, is readying you for what's supposed to come next. And that is, you know, that to me, all of this is just my own opinion, but there's a work of Zen that we do, that we Zen people do. And all of this is a very important, you know, builds up to open us so that we can be receptive to the Zen experience, which is what it is. Even these koans are basically an experience. I mean, when we talk about answering a koan, I mean, we can sit here and analyze this koan, and we can create all kinds of possibilities, but the really deep purpose of any koan, and they're designed by people that are marvelously awake, but the really deepest purpose is an experience. If we go to Sesshin, if we go on retreat, and we sit there for 8 hours a day, it's not so that we can figure out an answer to a koan. It's so that we can do in those few days more of what we've been doing our whole life and we haven't realized it, which is to be available to whatever situation will offer us a taste of something that goes so deep inside of us, and the result of that will be not an answer that comes into your head, but an experience. An experience. And part of the Zen effort for me, the good effort, the work of Zen, has been to learn not to look for. It's been to learn to open up to whatever possible experience might happen, and to pay attention, not to sit on a cushion and wait for a big event or some kind of, you know, fantastic thing that's going to happen. There are experiences that are pretty dramatic in Zen, but that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about working with a koan, working with the little phrase in the koan that keeps coming back. You keep saying it over and over again. Nothing's happening. Nothing's happening. Nothing seems to be happening at all. But it is doing what all those early life experiences did for me in a certain way, I think. It's preparing you at some level for the moment when you open up and experience something. But you have to pay attention. You have to learn, which is what I had to do. I had to learn to pay attention. I had to learn to be observant to what? What's the word? Pay attention, be observant. It'll come to me. And that's what goes back to all of what we see as this struggling. We sit down on the cushion and it's just one thought after another, it's one feeling after another, it's like whatever's been going on just takes over. And so that's the work, cleaning house, just sitting there. Well, you don't have to really do anything except keep turning back to your breath. Just keep watching your breath. This goes on for a long time for some people. But once you get past that, that's when things can start to happen. So, getting back to this particular koan and what at this particular moment is striking me. This carp in the net, I started thinking, well, maybe we're kind of born in a net. We kind of start out life in this invisible kind of net, and things happen to us that actually can constrict us more, make it harder to see what's real. So, my parents were divorced when I was 3, and we went to live with a grandmother and an aunt, and my grandmother was old, my mother and my aunt were middle-aged. My aunt was what we called in those days a maiden lady. That's if you were kind. Some people would call her an old maid. I don't know if they still use that term. But she never married. She was a good-hearted person in a lot of ways. But she didn't really know how to parent very well. There was no way she could have. And her way of of structuring or disciplining was to make a person feel very guilty. So that was kind of the outline of how I grew up. And at the time, you know, it was just something that happened. You know, she'd stop talking to me for 2 days. Meanwhile, I'm 6 years old, and that's what you would not do with a six-year-old child. But she did that if she was annoyed enough. And but strangely enough, I started having these dreams when I was a child, and it would be just as I was waking up, and I would be like totally paralyzed. I would be like totally, I couldn't move. And sometimes I'd be frightened, but most of the time I would just be struggling and struggling. I thought of that. I hadn't thought of that in years until I started thinking about this koan. And that's kind of how I felt in my house. But I didn't realize any of that. To me, I was just a kid, and I'd go play with my friends, and I thought life was good, and I didn't realize what was going on around me, and the attitudes and the feelings of people around me were impacting on me. And there was another, my mother had to go to work in the afternoon. She'd leave at like 4:30 or 5 o'clock, and she wouldn't come back until midnight. In those days, they didn't have computers, so banks had to hire people to put checks into a machine after the bank closed to prove it out. And so she'd work until about midnight. But I used to love, this was a happy memory I had. I used to love to stand at the bathroom door and just watch her put on makeup, which she didn't use a lot of, but she used certain things. And I used to love to watch her do that. And I used to think about when I got older, I could do that too. And so I grew up with this as a happy memory of my mother. And I didn't have her at night the way most kids had their parents. So I had to make the most of the time I had with her. And but you know, as an adult, one time I thought of that memory, and all of a sudden my whole being got so sad, I wanted to cry. It was my mind, it was my body. I just felt so bottomed out. And I realized that all those years I had been enjoying watching her, but at the same time, underneath, been so sad that she was leaving again. So very unhappy. And I would be alone for probably almost 2 hours till my aunt came home. And I used to have a very, very active fantasy life. That was my way of escaping the loneliness of being alone for those 2 hours and without any grown-up around me. So the point of that is that so often, we start off life, we're in samsara, so it's not going to be perfect, and we're all going to have things that bind us, that grip us. But then as we go along, it compounds a little, you know, so the work of, the progression through life, and people tend to look for ways of making themselves comfortable, of taking away that all of that. And I remember reading, it was a Baha'i author, Baha'i religion, years and years ago again, that this world is soul school. That was another little detail in a book that changed my mind a little bit, that pointed me again away from just finding comfort in things and to the idea that I had to do something to help myself change and be happy. And so, another image in Buddhism is returning to the marketplace. And that's something we all, each of us, I mean, when you read it in these in Zen books, it means after Daikensho, coming back into the marketplace and living differently. But there's another level to that too, that I think, that where we get up every morning and we go out into the marketplace, and we have to return every day. And that's the wonder of this practice. It's the strength of us. It becomes the strength of us. It just changes so much. In the life doesn't change. The situations don't change. But we still have to face things. We still have problems and all that. But the joy of this practice is finding a clear place. After you clean house, after you have learned to empty yourself a little bit from all the monkey mind stuff that is in there, after you've learned to do that and you reach that wonderful clear place, over time, if you continue to practice for years, that will become a really important part of your life. That will help you in your everyday life, in the marketplace, not only here on the cushion, in the marketplace too, which is at least as important as here. And so that is the best part of this practice that I've learned. Engo's introduction, 7 piercing and 8 breaking through, seizing the drums and capturing the banners, 100 barriers and 1,000 checkpoints, watching the front and guarding the rear, holding the tiger's head and securing its tail. Even all of these are not comparable to the veteran master's ability. I don't think you have to be even a veteran master. I think if you just really give yourself your whole heart to this practice and trust it, over time, you'll be on top of anything, or you'll be able to deal with anything. The ox head disappearing, the horse head appears. That also is not a great wonder. Tell me, what do you do when a man of transcendent experience comes? See the following. Sancho said to Seppo, the golden carp is out of the net. Tell me, what will it feed on? Seppo said, when you have got out of the net, I will tell you. Sancho said, the renowned teacher of 1,500 monks cannot find even one word to say about this topic. Seppo said, I am the chief abbot and have much to attend to. It almost strikes me that he's saying to him, go back and sit on your cushion. You still have work to do. Secho's verse. The golden carp comes out of the net. Don't say it remains in the water still. It shakes the heavens and moves the earth, swinging its fins, lashing its tail. It blows like a whale raising great waves. Then the thunder sounds and a cool breeze comes. We get to our center. We reach there. One day on the cushion, all of a sudden that happens. Nothing's the same after that. A cool breeze, yes, a cool breeze comes. Who in the whole universe knows this?